I'm Bex and welcome to the Week Junior Show. Today I'm joined by three of the team from the Week Junior, the magazine making sense of the world for 8 to 14 year olds. We've got managing editor Vanessa.
Hello.
Art director Dave.
Hello.
And writer Michael.
Hello.
This week, we'll be talking about mysterious lines carved into a desert, an ice age adventure told through fossilised footprints, and the UK's most influential people with disabilities. Plus, we'll have a debate all about football teams. But before all of that, seeing as we will be discussing the ice age, I thought I would ask, what is your favourite animal from that period of history? Vanessa, you can go first.
Well, this was quite difficult, actually, because there are a lot of animals around in the Ice Age. I mean, pretty furry ones, but they were around. Anyway, tapirs are my favourite, and they are still around. And they look a bit like a pig with a trunk, in fact. And the mountain, or woolly tapir, is the smallest and lives high in the Andes Mountains in South America.
Lovely stuff, a tapir. Yeah, I can picture that. I know that one. Dave, what have you gone for?
My favourite Ice Age animal is a saber-toothed cat for no other reason than I love cats. You might be thinking it should be saber-toothed tiger, but no, the correct term is cat. As many species of saber-toothed cat have lived during the last 40 million years. They became extinct due to environmental change, lack of food and human hunting, and they got their name from the long dagger-like canines that protruded from the side of their mouths.
I didn't know that. Excellent fact. Michael, how about you?
Mine is the woolly mammoth, and it's only because my favourite character from the Ice Age films, Manny, was the woolly mammoth.
I'm so glad someone's mentioned the Ice Age film, because that was my first point of reference for this question. I have gone for reindeer, though. I found out that reindeers also existed in the Ice Age, which I didn't realise. And I thought that would be a lovely idea of having reindeers in the Ice Age. That's the one I've picked. I also want to find out what is everybody's favourite fact from this week. Vanessa, what have you gone for?
Mine is that a rhino's skin is between 1 and 5 centimetres thick. It's thicker on their backs, thinner on their tummies and thinner around their ears. They like to have their ears tickled by only the very brave. I certainly wouldn't try it. But apparently, even though their skin is so thick, they still get sunburned. So they roll in mud to protect themselves.
Dave, what fact have you learnt?
Well, my favourite fact is from the on-screen page, and it's a story about how the BBC's new microbit computer has got a more powerful upgrade to version 2. And a lot of our readers and listeners have probably used one at school. And the fact is, the BBC's first computer for schools launched in 1981. The most popular model, the BBC B, cost £335, nearly £1,300 in today's money, whereas the entry-level microbit was started at a more affordable £12. There are, of course, differences in the devices, but it's certainly easier to get into computers now than it was back then. And actually, if you can imagine, when I was at school in 1981... I'd have been around 13. There were no computers in schools or homes, or at least they're very uncommon. And it was pretty much the dawn of the home computer revolution.
Oh, wow. You were there at the brink of technology, Dave.
I was, with my
Amazing.
BBC B.
Michael, tell me, what have you found out?
I found out that our brains actually generate enough electricity to power a small light bulb. And you can find out many more fascinating facts about the brain in our All About the Brain feature in this week's issue of The Week Junior.
Oh my goodness, not only a great fact, but also a great plug for the magazine, Michael. Well done. You've done this before, I can tell. Now it's time for real or rubbish. This is when I hear a story from one of you guys, and I have to guess whether it is indeed real or rubbish. Who is telling me the story this week?
I am. So obviously a lot of people are working from home at the moment because of coronavirus, and we're all recording this podcast from our separate homes. But imagine if we were recording this podcast from the top of a Ferris wheel in a theme park, because that is what some people in Japan are doing. A theme park in Japan has introduced what they call an amusement workcation, which offers an alternative to working from home where people can go and work at a theme park instead. They get their own table and chair, power supply, Wi-Fi connection, and then throughout the day, they also have access to all of the other roller coasters and attractions at the park. It costs around £14 a day on weekdays to go and do this. So what do you think, Bex? Does this story sound true to you, or have our lies reached new heights?
I really want this to be true. Can you imagine doing this show as we're all on different waltzes? I mean, how fun would that be, all like whirling around? I mean, we'd probably be a little bit ill. But how cool would that be? That sounds amazing. And do they get to go on any ride at all?
Yeah, so they can go, a lot of people are going onto the Ferris wheel, working from the top of the Ferris wheel, but while they're there, they can also go to any of the other attractions in the park.
My only concern with this, as to why I'm doubting it, is when you say they'd be given power supplies, how do you get power on the top of a Ferris wheel? I can't imagine there are many plug sockets up there. That's my issue.
Life finds a way.
You're not giving anything away, Michael. I really want this to be true. I won't lie to you, because then if it is, we can make this podcast happen from crazy new heights. And that appeals to me a lot. Oh, probably not on a log flume, though. That would be quite tricky. I'll have a little think about this. And I guess we'll find out the answer at the end of the podcast. If you're listening and you've not read your copy of the magazine yet, make your guess before the end of the show and we can find out the answer together. So now it's time for our three big stories from the week. Vanessa, what story are you telling us about?
Well, I'm pretty excited this week because we are celebrating disability. Well, the Shaw Trust is, which is a charity set up to help people with disabilities find employment and develop their careers. And the BBC presenter, Nikki Fox, has been given the title of the most influential disabled person in the UK, which is on, and that's on the Disability Power 100 list. Now, around 1 in 20 children under the age of 16 have a disability, according to the Shaw Trust that set up this list. And as we know, role models are extremely important for people, hence the Disability Power list, which has been going for about 5 years now. And Nikki Fox, she was born with muscular dystrophy, which weakens your muscles, which made it quite difficult at school because she said, you know, walking between classrooms, she would never know if she was about to topple over. She also had dyslexia, which made reading and writing difficult for her. But even so, she became a journalist, which you might think was an odd choice. But she had such a passion for telling people's stories that she went to work for the BBC and she became the disability correspondent in 2014. And across the list, I think it's the diversity of people honoured that's really striking. One of the other people on the list is Cameron Malik, who runs Disability Rights UK, which fights for a more equal society. Leo Lake, who's a young actor, he's thought to be the first registered blind person to perform on stage in London's famous West End, which is the name given to the top theatres in London. He was Tiny Tim in A Christmas Carol. Emily White, who's 14, she's on the list as well. She campaigns about childhood disability and has written various comic books to help people understand the issues that face people with disabilities. Sienna Castellan, aged 18, she recently set up Neurodiversity Celebration Week to celebrate how different people are. And this is really the point of this, I think. It's really kind of celebrating people's differences. And Anne Wafula-Strike, who is the Paralympic wheelchair racer, she was the first wheelchair user from East Africa to compete at the Paralympics back in 2004. She's in the top 10. And she said something that really stuck with me. She said, "Knowing you are not defined by your disability is the sweetest thing," she said. And I think that's something we should all kind of work towards, that, you know, seeing beyond first impressions to the real person underneath. And that's what these awards really, really show us.
Yeah, I've got one of my little relatives was born without his lower leg on the left-hand side. And it's just not set him back at all. But I think that's partly because you see people like this who inspire you and you think, I can do anything. It doesn't really matter.
Exactly, exactly. With these kind of role models, I just hope that it opens a lot of doors for people.
Dave, tell me, what have you been finding out about?
My story is that scientists in the US discovered the longest trail of fossilised footprints in the world. Fossils are remains or impressions of ancient living things that have been preserved in rock. The almost mile-long set of footprints is around 10,000 years old and was preserved in the bed of an ancient lake in the modern-day state of New Mexico. Now, the tracks are so well preserved that the team of researchers were able to create a timeline of events based on them. The tracks show two people, a man or possibly a woman, with a child around the age of two, who were quickly walking along a path to reach their destination. The gap between each step shows that they were moving faster than normal walking pace, and they were heading in a clear direction. And the tracks show that the child was carried, but put down by the adult every so often. And a separate set of prints later the same day shows that the grown-up returned the same way, but on their own. So the researchers think that this could suggest, unfortunately, a sad ending for the child, but it's also possible that the grown-up was just taking the child home, made a return journey later on for a different reason. Now, what's even more incredible is the evidence they weren't totally alone on the day. The footprints cross over with those of two animals that seem to have been on the same path, although not at the same time as the humans. A mammoth made its way across the route and was clearly uninterested in the fact that people had been nearby because its footprints don't show any evidence that it stopped or changed path. However, a giant sloth also arrived on the scene and did show an interest in its fellow walkers, and its prints revealed that it reared up onto its hind legs as it crossed the human's route, probably to sniff the air, and then dropped back down to all fours and walked on by.
That's incredible. I feel like you've just told me a story, and there was so little, just the kind of footsteps, but you, there was so much there, Dave. That was incredible.
With the fact that they can work out the speed, how many people, the child from the depression of the footprints was picked up and put down, and the animals would have wandered around and interacted with the scent that would have been lingering in the air. The fact that we can deduce all this from a few fossilized footprints is incredible, I think.
Michael, tell me, what have you been finding out about?
So my story is about how a giant drawing of a cat has been discovered in Peru's Nazca Desert. Now, it's thought to be one of the Nazca lines, which are a series of mysterious designs that were etched into the desert as long as 2,000 years ago. And they were made by a group of people called the Nazca who lived on the southern coast of Peru from around 200 BC to 600 AD. And they made these pictures into the desert by removing surface rocks to reveal the paler sand underneath. And these designs can actually only be seen in full from the sky. So they didn't actually come to people's attention until planes started flying over the desert in the 1930s. And to this day, nobody knows for sure why these drawings were made, what their purpose was. And now a brand new drawing has been found, and you can see a picture of it in this week's issue. And it's a 37 meter long drawing of a cat made up of lines that are between 30 to 40 centimeters thick. Now, it was found by workers who were clearing a path to an observation deck where people can look out at some of the other lines. And you might be wondering how such a huge drawing of a cat in the desert could have not been seen for such a long time. However, they say it was because it was on a very steep hill, and actually the picture had almost disappeared because of erosion, which is when parts of the earth are gradually worn away by natural forces like wind and water. Now that they've found the drawing, it's been cleaned up and they're going to protect and preserve it so other people can see it. And according to experts who have been looking at the drawing, they think it might actually have been created before the Nazca civilization by a group of people called the Paracas, who lived from 500 BC to 200 AD. And that's because similar drawings of cats have been found on their pottery and on their clothing. So even though they're called the Nazca lines, some of them might even have predated the Nazca civilization. And what's quite exciting about this is that because of new technologies such as satellites and drones, people are finding new Nazca lines all of the time. So just last year, a team of researchers from Japan found more than 140 new designs in the desert that no one had seen before. So who knows what other drawings we might find in the desert in the future and what other animals they might have drawn all those many thousands of years ago.
I've seen a picture of this actually, and it is amazing because you can tell it's a cat and it is quite recognisable. And it's kind of fun to think that they were probably drawing the same things that like we would draw now. Like I would doodle a cat, you know, maybe not in that much detail and not in that much height and width, but still, it's pretty cool, isn't it? It feels like you've got a connection with them.
Yeah, exactly. And like you were saying, I mean, people are still to this day trying to figure out why they made these drawings. Some people think it could be something to do with aliens or something else. But I quite like the explanation that you just said, that they were just drawing them for the same reasons that we draw and doodle things now, just because they could and it was just a bit of fun.
Now it's time for our big debate. This week we're asking whether the Premier League should be smaller. Who can tell me a little bit more?
That's me, and I'm the big expert on football at the Week Junior, because I've never been to a football match apart from Shrewsbury Town 40 years ago. I've never watched it on TV, and I've never played it apart from school, but I can read and I don't have to debate about it, so I'm going to tell you everything you need to know. The Premier League is England's top football league. The three leagues below are the Championship League, League One and League Two. The clubs, particularly in the lower leagues, are struggling because of coronavirus. Fans can't go to matches and ticket sales how clubs make a lot of their money. Two Premier League clubs, Liverpool and Manchester United, I guess they're the good ones, came up with a plan that involved giving the lower leagues $250 million to help them through the coronavirus outbreak. And this plan included a number of proposals, such as reducing the number of Premier Leagues from 20 to 18.
Very interesting stuff. You say you don't know much about football, but that was very well explained. So this is going to be interesting because we've got Vanessa versus Michael. Michael, I know, is a football fan. So I'll be interested in this one. You guys have to say why the Premier League should be smaller. You have a minute, remember, a minute. I'm just putting it out there again. A minute, Vanessa. And I guess you're going first, Vanessa. You're going to say why you think it should be smaller, right?
Yes.
Right, well, whenever you're ready, take it away.
Okay, well, I say that having so many teams in the Premier League means that there are just too many matches. The season's too long, and it means that players have a greater risk of getting injured. Yes, you might have fewer matches with fewer teams, but the football will be of higher quality. You know that you'll be watching the best of the best, and they will be properly rested before they play. It also means that there will be space for new competitions. One of the ideas suggested in the Project Big Picture is for summer Premier League tournaments every 5 years, and that would only work in a smaller league. There's a worry that smaller clubs will be locked out of the Premier League forever, and it would just be the same teams playing over and over, but that's not necessarily true. Clubs' fortunes change over time with changes of managers and new players coming up, and clubs that once dominated everything are challenged. I say cut down the Premier League and give more support to the lower leagues.
Wow, that was super quick. Oh my goodness, I feel bad for telling you off now. That was amazing, Vanessa. Right. Well, now, Michael, this is your chance to challenge back. Whenever you're ready, Michael, take it away.
Well, as Vanessa said, reducing the number of teams in the Premier League means that there are fewer opportunities for teams from the lower leagues to get into the Premier League. So that means there'll be fewer fans that have the chance to see their club play at the very, very, very top level. And the best thing about the Premier League is how unpredictable it is. So a few years ago, Leicester won the Premier League. Nobody expected that. They'd only recently come up from the Championship. And under this new proposal, with two fewer spots in the Premier League, it would have been even harder for them to have got into the Premier League in the first place. And if there's only 18 clubs, it's more likely that it will be the same teams year after year, and that will become less exciting. And as a football fan, as someone who goes to matches, I like to see my team play lots of games. And if there's fewer teams, that means there's fewer matches and fewer opportunities for me to go and see my team play and enjoy the football. So I say keep the Premier League as it is, or if you want to change it, let's have more teams, more matches, more football, make it even bigger.
No!
Wow, Michael's really, really taking it the opposite way there. Dave, what do you reckon?
I personally prefer less football, but I know that most people absolutely love it. It's just something that has never entered my world at all, and I don't know why. I know most kids play football and watch football and love it. I'm kind of going with Michael because he's the big football fan. I think he knows what he's talking about.
I had a similar thought. I thought, you know what, Michael knows his football, and the good point about Leicester City as well. And if you want it to be a little bit interesting, totally understand that. Get more and more teams and more players in there. Why not, Michael?
Exactly.
There's the Premier League with 50 different teams. So this is your chance to let us know what you think by responding to the poll online. Go to theweekjunior.co.uk/polls or email hello@theweekjunior.co.uk with a video clip explaining what side of the debate you support and why. Last week, we debated on the podcast whether drive-ins were the best way to enjoy events. And almost two-thirds of you, 73%, said no, while 27% thought that drive-ins should keep happening after the lockdown. Here's some of your comments.
We had a brilliant comment sent in by Nola. Here's what she had to say.
Hello, my name is Nola and I'm 11 years old. I can see both sides of this week's debate because on one side, I think that having drive-in events would be great because we can still all go to lots of places. But on the other hand, I think that socialising is one of the most special parts of particular occasions such as weddings. I think that overall my vote would have to go with no, drive-in events are not a good idea.
Nadia also emailed us explaining that she could see both sides. She wrote yes and no. Yes during this time, but I think a drive-in would be a bit uncomfortable and I personally won't like it. It will also create carbon emissions.
A lot of people thought it was a good solution for now. One Pop Jam user wrote, I'm half and half. Not for parties or events with family and friends, because then you can't talk to anyone, dance or meet new people. However, nowadays it is the safer option, and it means that people can still come together and carry on.
Another pop jammer agreed, commenting, "I think they're great for the moment because of the COVID-19 restrictions, but they might not be very practical for every event going forward." Someone else wrote, "Yes, because you can enjoy the event from the comfort of your own car."
All very interesting points of view. So as you heard, this is your chance to get involved. Grab a grown-up and record a video telling us what you think of this week's debate. Then send it in to us at hello@theweekjunior.co.uk, and we could play it out on next week's show, You Will Be Famous. So now it's time for our real or rubbish reveal. Michael, can you remind me about the story again, please?
Yes, so this was the story that people were working from the top of a Ferris wheel at a theme park in Japan, among other attractions, as an alternative to working from home.
Right, so like I said, the power socket situation has confused me. I can't imagine plugging in your laptop at the top of a Ferris wheel, but I do like the idea of it. I love the idea of being on a roller coaster and trying to do a podcast, or being on the teacups and thinking, oh, I've got to write this essay. So just because of the novelty value, I'm going to say it's real. I'm going to say it's true. That's my answer.
Drum roll, please. It's real.
Yes!
Hey!
It's actually real.
It is real. And there's even been special workstations set up by the swimming pool as well, apparently. So just the Ferris wheel.
That's mad. Electronics and swimming pools. Saying, yes,
that doesn't seem like the best idea. But who knows, maybe, you know, if Thought Park or Alton Towers or Legoland want to do something similar, then maybe we could do the Week Junior show from the top of a Ferris wheel as well.
Oh my goodness. Can you imagine doing it from like the top of Nemesis or Oblivion just before you go down on that really big 90 degree turn? We could do the big debate. How cool would that be? Should we get
I'd have a very wobbly, high pitched voice, I think. Quite breathless.
Has anyone been on Oblivion? It really is.
Yes.
Horrendous.
No, I've watched it from a distance and thought, I'm not doing that. What struck me is that everybody's legs swing back and forth when they come out the other side. Apparently it's adrenaline. So if you watch people coming out of Oblivion, all their legs are going, woo, wiggling about.
I did it once. The kids went back time and time again. I did it once just, and I was terrified. It was, I don't know why people want to go back. Sorry.
So you guys are out of the Week Junior trip to Alton Towers, but me and Michael, do you fancy it?
Yeah, I'll be up for it.
Brilliant stuff, we'll get that sorted. I'm pretty sure that'll happen. That is it for the Week Junior show this week. So goodbye to Vanessa.
Hi.
To Dave.
Hi.
And Michael.
Goodbye.
Drop us a comment on Pop Jam at the Week Junior or email hello@theweekjunior.co.uk if you want to get in touch. Plus, don't forget to rate, review and subscribe wherever it is you get your podcast from. Bye.
If you want to get your hands on a copy of the Week Junior magazine, we're offering a 6-week free trial. To get yours, head over to dennismags.co.uk/theweekjunior and use the code PODCAST.